Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagram Radian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Jerry Hendricks on his new book about sea power. But first, joining us now is our very own contributing editor, Chris Cavas, one of the world's leading naval writers and thinkers about sea power and naval history. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Always good, Vago.
Always a pleasure indeed. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Chris, we both attended a week of Surface Navy Association, not quite the same thing, but virtual and a terrific conference. Nonetheless, we had an opportunity to talk to Rick Hunt, former Surf War, who is also the president of SNA, I should also point out. Yeah, he is also the top executive at Fincantieri Marinette Marine, our naval sponsor. What were the key takeaways this year from SNA from your standpoint, right? I mean, it is one of, it's not only the Surface Forces premier conference, but it's also one of the Navy's most important conferences each year. And we also heard from the Chief of Naval Operations. What caught your attention?
Well, it is an important conference. It's the first conference of the year, major naval conference of the year. So people always look at it to sort of set the tone. I don't know what tone they set or what tone they were trying to set. The Chief of Naval Operations, Mike Gilday's talk was okay. It was, but again, I'm disappointed that he talks about trying to decommission ships and rather than get better use out of the assets that he has now. He has initiatives going. He put out this navigation plan, which is okay. But nothing really very emphatic. There's no clear rudder order going on anywhere. The head of the Surface Forces, Admiral Kitchener, spoke from San Diego. Actually, he had a recorded piece that played where he was in the mission bay of one of the littoral combat ships based out there. I sort of gave him a B+ for that, good optics, but he didn't talk much about littoral combat ship. And that was, I was disappointed. People talk about frigate, which is obviously the very new, the biggest thing happening now in surface warfare programs. People talked about now DDGX, the large surface combatant, which the Navy was claiming, we don't want to call it a cruiser or a destroyer. We're going to call it a large surface combatant. Well, now it's a destroyer, so DDGX. Right. Still not a lot of viz on that. The construction program, the acquisition program seems ambitious since they don't have there's no concept people have been putting forth. They put forth, actually showed in one of the briefings, they had a representation for a DDGX, which used a DDG 1000, the Zumwalt class hull, something that looked like it, except with a more conventional bow. And everybody kind of went, oh, I guess that's what they're thinking of. And then later on, they said, we're not thinking of that at all. So I don't know what they're thinking
about. here's a representation of what we're not going to do.
Yeah. So for everything that you began to infer, it sounds like they're thinking about this. If you ask directly about it, they would say, well, we're not doing that, or we don't know, or whatever. So it wasn't, you know, if you came out with any information on that, I think you're better than most people, because they were consistently inconsistent, I thought. They are talking, and oddly, they didn't talk about littoral combat ship. I thought that was interesting. There are four LCS is going to be commissioned this year. That's four times more than anything else that's going to be commissioned this year.
Right.
The Proceedings magazine, Naval Institute Proceedings, I thought correctly had two very good articles on LCS. It is the largest surface combatant program going on right now.
Right.
And they all but ignored it. They barely talked about it.
Well, so let me get your take on that, right? Because one of the news stories that broke immediately afterwards was, I mean, obviously we've known that there's a challenge with the gearbox on the Freedom class ships. We talked to Vice Admiral Bill Galinas, the Naval Sea Systems Command commander, about that during our interview. You know, he made it seem like, you know, there's a solution that's in sight. And right after the conference, the Navy suspended acceptance of those ships. Talk to us about the problem, why it's so vexing, where we are, and what's next.
So with the Freedom-class ships, this is the Lockheed Martin class that is built up at Fincante Area Marinette Marine. There's a combining gear issue, combined gas turbines and diesels, and there's a combining gear. So it's sort of like a clutch in your car, although a bit more complex. And there have been problems with the combining gear for some years on different ships. The problem has been that it's manifested itself in different ways. It's not been consistent, and it doesn't show up when the ships are new. The ship, they run fine, then you run them for a while and something happens. So it has caused the Navy to reduce to not trust the reliability of the class. And as a result, they haven't been operating at the level that they probably should be. There are many questions about the problem, what is the problem, and then who's responsible. But what is the problem? How widespread is the problem? And then who's responsible?
And so, Renk is the manufacturer of the gearbox, if I'm correct, right? So
there's a German company, Renk, R-E-N-K-A-G, makes these gears. Renk has been around for many, many years, makes lots of reduction gears, manual transmissions, all this. This is what they do. But they're a subcontractor to Lockheed. One of the issues was a determination whether or not this was a problem with individual ships, the individual installation, or was it a class-wide issue? So right. Although it would appear to the uninitiated like us that, of course, it's a class-wide issue, they finally just certified last week that this is indeed a class-wide issue. That means that they have identified a fix. It's a fairly extensive fix to this piece of equipment. But now they figured out what they need to do, and the extent of it. They're going to have to do it on 11 ships, all the ships that have this gear, and then of course backfit into the future ships. So the issue now is scheduling that, and how exactly will that be carried out? They're probably going to have to do a hull cut, probably have to actually build a cofferdam under the ships, so they don't have to dry dock them. And in my mind, this is a good news story, and that this vexing problem, which has plagued this class for many years, a solution may be in hand. So the first ship the fix will be put on is the Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is LCS-21, was actually ran acceptance trials last August. And the Navy didn't accept it, but passed acceptance trials, passed very well, very high scoring ship. No problems, but the Navy is going to keep that ship up in Marinette through the winter. They will do the fix first up there. They'll do sea trials up there. There is a background to that there's a ridiculous requirement that the ship's commissioning ceremony is Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some nice politician decided, wouldn't it be nice if we did it in Minnesota? So in late May, they're going to have a commissioning ceremony in Duluth, Minnesota, right at the other end of Lake Superior, where no littoral combat ship has been. And it would be kind of silly to go all the way back to the Great Lakes and all the way to the end for the commissioning ceremony. So they're going to actually wind up keeping it up there. That's sort of neither here nor there, but it's a problem that not of the Navy's making, but they're trying to make applesauce out of apples. This in general, I think this should be looked at as a good news story. And there've been a number of commentators who talk about all these things never should have been built, and this is a terrible mistake. We should cancel them right now. Well, we've made an enormous investment in these ships. We're still building them. There are many already in service. We need to get some use out of them. You need to make them work, and that's sort of the attitude that I'm looking for from the Navy this year, is that I didn't hear a whole lot coming out of the Service Navy Association about let's make it work.
Make it work is also the piece of the is the title of the great commentary that's on our website. And I would commend the audience to check it out, because that's the point you drive home. But Chris, there are so many elements of this program that are still, you know, the CNO wants to retire the first four ships, the prototype right. ships, which are obviously important for the schoolhouse to sort of train and do some of the work that we want to do on it. The Navy's answer is these are kind of non-standard and not representative of the rest of the class. Okay, but they still have, you know, half their lives, you know, they've still got a lot of service life in them. The surface warfare package is out. The mine warfare package is delayed. The ASW package is, the anti-submarine package is delayed. Where are we on this program and where are we going, right? I mean, because the Navy keeps talking about the deployment of the handful of available ships, but at the end of the, end of the day, it is not leveraging the full class, and the full class is not doing all of the missions from counter mine to anti-submarine that it's supposed to do, that they're supposed to do.
So Admiral Kitchener, again in San Diego, who took command in the middle of last summer, initiated yet another review effort to look at the roles and missions of the ships and the configuration of the mission packages. And that is a study that is remains in progress. He referenced it at SNA saying, you know, we'll have that out soon, whatever soon means. I guess part of the thing is we've been hearing this talk. It all sounds good on the surface and individually, but we've heard people say these things many, many times before. There have been lots of people with stars and big broad stripes on their sleeves who have said the same things before, over and over. And people come in and we want to review it, we want to change it, and now we have it's been 2-3 years affecting our changes, and then they're gone, and somebody else comes in and says, well, we have to review it again. And meanwhile, nobody's deploying. And the Navy will argue that the ships are very busy. They're out training. Well, we didn't buy them to train. The Navy will say, well, we had three of them deployed to Fourth Fleet. Fourth Fleet is Central America over the past few months. That's true. But we didn't buy these ships to deploy to Fourth Fleet. We bought them to deploy to the Persian Gulf and Singapore and the Mediterranean. And right. they're not there. One ship, they've done a handful of sort of almost demonstration deployments, but there's no consistency in it. So I guess what I'm looking for, I think the carrier program, the Gerald R. Ford program, long troubled, another very complex program with many, many layers to it. I thought that they culturally turned the corner in the fall of 2019. Ship came out of a long shipyard period. And since then, they've been very active. They're really pushing it forward. There's a whole different spirit in that. There remains a work in progress. There's a lot of work still to go. It's not finished. But the attitude around that program is 180 degrees from where it was. And I think they've made enormous progress in 2020. I would like to see those attitudes elsewhere. So the other part, SNA, like unmanned. Nobody knows where anything is going in unmanned because the Navy would like to move ahead. And frankly, there are elements in Congress that are sort of stopping them every time they try to move ahead, not so fast. And the Congress itself has slowed down many of these programs, including the modules. And sort of the, you know, apple before the cart, they deal with you haven't fully developed these things. Well, I can't fully develop these things if you don't give me the money right. to buy enough of these things to fully develop them. Well, you know, we'll just wait and see. We'll just review. And it goes around and around and around and nothing gets going. So there are these problems that there are out there.
Let me just ask you one last question briefly. Our next guest is going to be talking about the importance of growing the Navy. You know, you've been covering this space for a long time, are an advocate for sea power, but also understand the importance of sort of a more balanced joint force. Navy has been making the case, and the last administration bought off on it, that a bigger Navy will be the deterrent for China. Although most strategists say air power will be important, and indeed elements of land power, particularly forward in the Pacific, will be important. How does this play out, do you think, in the new administration?
I don't know. We don't know all the personalities yet, do we? It's still coming into it's coming into view. It's an excellent question. It's certainly the premier question. I mean, I personally believe the Navy is deserving of great investment here. Air power never quite lives up to its billing. Land power.
Airmen would disagree with that, but well, I take your point.
Then we have to point to history, because the Sherman Drang is always there, but the results aren't. Land forces are not of much use in the vast, enormous Pacific. God help us. I hope nobody ever considers a land conflict on the mainland of China. So we don't need that. But naval forces have an immense impact, very much out of proportion to what you see. And the Navy has to do far better at communicating that, at getting people to understand that. And the naval programs take incredibly long to develop and field, and they're very expensive. And it's a major issue. They have to be better stewards of what they have now, and they have to do a better job at moving forward.
Chris, thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago.
And joining us today is Dr. Jerry Hendricks, a retired United States Navy captain and P-3 aviator, who is one of America's leading naval strategists. He is now with the Telemus Consultancy and the author of a new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry, Happy New Year. Congratulations on the new book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Vago.
Always a pleasure having you on. I know you've been working hard on this book. As I recall, the genesis of it, it's a great title, drawing off the Constitution, obviously, the founding fathers understanding the value of sea power. But why did you write the book, and why now?
Well, I mean, the reason was, obviously, we had the era of COVID. So, what do I do with all this time when I'm not commuting? and also the general frustration that I've been writing for the better part of a decade now about naval force structure, making arguments for a greater size of the Navy, as well as a different architecture within that number, as it were, talking about high-low mixes. And what I began to realize is that those arguments were not getting traction. They just were going nowhere. And it's not just me. I think there's a number of other people who we both know and respect a lot have also been making similar arguments. And it appeared to me that what we're really facing is the fact that the United States as a nation really has sort of lost sight of the importance of the sea. We've lost our knowledge of why navies are important, what the role that they serve in the world today, and why it is absolutely critical right now at this moment in our history as we're facing this great power competition, that we become refocused on the sea, what it does for us, as well as the importance of the Navy within that. So I wanted to sit down and tell the rest of the story, which by and large had become assumed amongst policymakers. When Navy leaders go to Capitol Hill, they make an argument for a larger Navy, and the people on the Hill look at it as a shipbuilding plan without really understanding the broader strategic implications of why. So there's no sense of the magnitude of the importance of what it is that we're doing right now. I wanted to bring that focus back into the conversation.
And as you said, right, people don't really understand sea power, much less maritime strategy, which is why we end up oftentimes just counting ships, right? I mean, that's a little bit easier. What are the deeper points you want to leave with readers?
Well, I mean, we are in a rising great power competition with China and Russia. Both of them are taking a different view of the sea. And in fact, they're taking opposing views to ideas and principles that we've held true to for in the West for nearly 400 years. So I wanted to start from the beginning. I wanted to talk about the importance of the concept of the free sea and why the free sea is essential to Western norms and rules. The idea that you can go from one part of the world across the oceans, unencumbered, uninterdicted, without a fear of a piracy of someone taking your goods. And what that principle has resulted in, we've seen in the last several hundred years, a growth of the global economy, which is triggered by maritime trade. A lot of the world's, some 90% of the world's trade goes by sea, by volume, and as well as by wealth. And so I wanted to sort of step back and look at that growing importance and what that wealth translates to in our day-to-day lives. The fact that we've seen increase in the longevity of human lives, the fact that we talk about the rise of human literacy, and sort of how these things track themselves back to this growing wealth, which stems from the idea of the free sea. So I wanted to start from there and talk about the fact that China and Russia are opposed to it. We see that in their day-to-day policies. as they seek to close the seas near them, Russia and the Arctic, China and the East China and South China Seas, and what those actions could mean for us. If they're able to succeed in closing portions of the world's oceans, it has significant implications for the rest of the world with the way that we route ships and so on. So I want to talk about that first. And then I also wanted to get into the idea of what the size of our Navy has meant in the past. We sort of get wound up in numbers today without understanding what the implications of what the numbers were in the past. So I told the story of the last 70 years and how it is that this 70 years is just historically an aberration, that we hadn't had this long period of time in history where we've gone this long without significant major battles. We'd had the Falklands War. We had some brief exchanges with the Iranians in the 1980s, but no major maritime battles. A lot of that has to do with the fact of the overwhelming size of the American fleet in combination with the fleets of our allies and partners. But as the fleet has shrank, when we got down to 271 ships in 2015, this sort of opened a window, created a vacuum, as it were, that invited Russia and China to begin competing at sea in a way that we hadn't seen in the last 70 years. So I wanted to bring those stories out to sort of tell where we are at this critical moment and why it's important that we begin to focus back on the sea, both as a national interest as well as from a global security perspective.
While you are talking about numbers, and we've had a multiplicity of numbers over the past decades that have become almost totemic in their value, although there are many people who would say we're not taking good enough care of the fleet we have before we add units to it, right? I mean, readiness rates are not as high as they should be. We lack the shipyard capability. We are not cycling through ships, right? I mean, there have been optimization plans by multiple generations of the Naval Sea Systems Command leaders and Navy leaders writ large. We heard from Vice Admiral Galinas, the NAVC, just last week. Talk to us a little bit about what your battle force of 456 ships by 2040, up from 295 today, would look like, how it's materially different, and how you get there, Jerry, given that you are asking the nation to make a $250 billion investment to get there.
Well, I thank you for phrasing it that way, because I think it's important to sort of step back and understand that this is sort of from the shoreline up approach. It's not just about growing the Navy. It's about growing the shipbuilding industrial base, which we've allowed to atrophy with regard to the number of graving docks, for instance, that can support and maintain our ships. We saw all those numbers decline in the 1990s and in the 2010s, where we got down to the point where we have this backlog of maintenance on the ships that we do have. And so I started with the idea that we need to grow. If you want to grow the Navy, then you grow the civilian shipbuilding base as well. So get back into building merchant marine civilian ships in the United States, or at least encourage that, because for every civilian or merchant ship that you build, you end up bringing down the overall cost of parts associated with building Navy ships, as well as creating an expanding workforce that, whether they're welders or pipe fitters or electricians, that can then transit over. So it's got to be sort of an overall approach to this. And then, once you have that investment in an industrial base, it becomes much easier to build a naval force. And in that force as well, look at some of these new platforms. So for instance, looking at large unmanned surface vessels and large unmanned underwater vessels, those don't necessarily have to be built in the same shipyards that are building your frigates and your destroyers. That gives you an opportunity to make an investment in a smaller yard, perhaps one that's located in a different region, thus diversifying your defense portfolio and creating redundancy in the event that you actually have to go to war someday. When we built the Perry class in the 1970s, we built in several yards. It just wasn't one yard. We now build, of course, destroyers in two yards. The submarines are in two yards. You need to kind of grow that resilience. And that's one of the things that I argue for in here, is to actually have a strategic plan for approaching your industrial base so that you can spread out your risk and try to lower your overall cost. And then, yes, it is going to cost more to grow the Navy. I talk about the fact of taking a Navy budget from where it is and growing anywhere from 25 to 30. And that number could go up as we get into the out years, obviously adjusting for inflation as we move forward. But the point that I make here is that the nation is, or was when it was founded, a sea power. That's written by the founders into the Constitution when they talk about providing and maintaining a Navy versus raising and supporting an army, hence a temporary force for the army, land force, and a permanent force for the Navy. We need to understand in the oceanic environment that we are now facing Russia and China, that we need to get focused back on that maritime environment, take a sea power view of the world, sort of moving away from the continentalist view that we've taken since essentially the end of the Korean War, and begin to get focused back on the environment, which is to our advantage, which is the offshore balancing approach of sea powers that we've seen across history. The U.S. was that in its beginning and should attempt to consciously become that again.
But we have made conscious decisions that have put us here, right? The Reagan administration decided that we were no longer going to subsidize commercial shipbuilding, something which every other successful commercial shipbuilding nation in the world does. We decided that capital markets would satisfy that, and obviously the United States could not be cost competitive. What does it take for us to get back into that business and be competitive in that business, right? And why should the Navy be given those resources, Jerry, given that many people look at the Navy's shipbuilding plans, and obviously the FFG 62, our sponsor, Fincantieri Marinette Marine, won the contract to build the Constellation class. And many people do see that frigate as turning a corner. But there are a lot of people who would look at the Navy's investment plans and say, we've given the Navy an awful lot of money to build DDG 1000, which ended up being unsuccessful, and certainly the littoral combat ship, where many people even in the Navy are asking what those ships are going to do ultimately before they may be retired, right? I mean, it may be the first class that actually doesn't do much before it ends up being first units of it will be retired, right? I mean, so what does it take in terms of different mindset, and why should the Navy be trusted with these resources, given that it's blown it a couple of times already?
Well, the ships that you speak of, the Zumwalt class, the littoral combat ships, both classes, as well as the Ford class aircraft carrier, were all designed and placed into the building process at a time when transformation was our strategy, not facing a major global power in the world at that time. Change became the strategy that we adopted and began to move out at. And obviously, that was a mistake. All three of those platforms have significant technological issues now and have become, sort of significant losers within our portfolio. The fact is we have identified what the strategic challenge is today. It is China. It is, to a lesser degree, Russia. We also have issues still remaining with Iran, although that's to a much lesser extent, as well as North Korea. And those challenges demand an oceanic response. We have the most flexibility, the most range of response by taking an oceanic approach to them. And so the Navy comes up as the number one priority if you're going to look at that strategic environment with air, space, and then land in sort of descending domains of importance below that. So you have to make your investments. You have to identify your strategic competitor, and then you have to make your investments accordingly. I have been a frequent critic of the Navy and its spending over the last 10 to 20 years. That doesn't mean that you simply say, well, you've been bad and therefore, you don't get anything more. The environment defines what we have to spend on. And right now we have to spend on the Navy. We have to prioritize in much the same way that, quite frankly, in the 1950s, we prioritized the Air Force and what would be the Space Force today as our response to the Soviet Union at that time. Having come to grips with the environment that we're in, you prioritize, and out of that priority right now, I believe, and that's why I've written this book, is to bring focus to it, that you focus back on sea power as an instrument, and then you have to focus on the Navy as a support to sea power strategy.
What do you see, right? So what do we need to ensure success in this endeavor? And what are the elements we have to be wary of that impede success?
Well, this book is meant to be a conversation starter. I deliberately wrote this book as a shorter format. The book is something that can be read in a single afternoon or an airplane flight. I was much influenced by a book that came out almost 20 years ago called A Paradise in Power, which gave this great description of the way that Europe and the United States looked at security. And I thought, I want to write something that's similar in its length and sort of the arc of the way that it's, it explains this. So this book is meant to be a conversation starter about our national strategy. And I want to have the book be readable to a mass audience, meaning, you know, I'd love to have people back home in my Midwestern hometown be able to read this book and understand what it is I'm saying. But more importantly, I want it to be a conversation starter amongst the broader policymaker, like members of Congress who are not necessarily from shipbuilding states, to come to understand the importance of the maritime environment, of transoceanic trade to the United States, of the importance of a free sea to us as a people, given, you know, our birth from the Enlightenment you know, ideas, and just understand the growing importance of the Navy and investment in the Navy as we move forward, if we really are going to try to win the competition against China and Russia. And so that was the purpose of this, is to be the part of that conversation. And, you know, in my dream of dreams, that this is something that will be read by members of the, you know, broader committee structure on Capitol Hill, and that it will be taken up as, you know, some of its bullets will be part of that conversation. I don't know, but I'm hopeful that we can get that around and, again, start this national conversation about the importance of the Navy.
Well, Jerry, you're one of the clearest thinkers and one of the best writers in our business. And so it's well written and certainly worth a read as all eyes descend on how the Biden administration is going to see where it picks up and how it picks up on what the Trump administration did. You know, we heard from the CNO at Surface Navy Association, and each administration is always building on the plans of the preceding administration, right? 355, as you note, was a number that came out in the late Obama administration, became a number that was picked up by the Trump administration, didn't progress as much as everybody would have liked. And so it's going to be certainly interesting and could match very well how a Democratic president who doesn't want to get involved in a lot of land conflicts, anybody who knows Joe Biden knows that. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether or not there will be more traction for naval, and I dare say even air power, in order to be able to exert influence at range with some persistence.
I agree. And again, I believe this to be a bipartisan issue. This is something that both sides could dig into and understand that, given this point in history and our place in the world, that a sea power approach is something that a consensus can be built behind. I've already begun to see indications of that just based upon people, policymakers on both sides of the aisle who have bought the book and then graciously tweeted out that they're reading it. So I'm pleased to see both R's and D's reading it at this point. And as I said, I'm anxious to engage them in conversation and to overcome this this era of sort of sea blindness that's come up as we became preoccupied with land wars in the Middle East. I think it's time to get our eyes back on the world's oceans and the competition that is heating up there.
A lot of eyes are reading the book as well. And I do have to say, as a dry dock lover, it is a graving dock lover. It's astonishing how many first-rate shipyards, whether in New York, in Philadelphia, or in California, have been really sacrificed and turned into something other than their original purpose. Because even at the time we were getting rid of them, folks were warning, we may regret doing this. And unfortunately, that's where we are now. Jerry, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And I commend our audience to check out the book. It's really quite tremendous. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you very much, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.